Hello and welcome to the End of Seeking podcast, episode 27. This is probably like take 5 or something. We've been having trouble lately, haven't we?
Series of unfortunate events, yeah. I think, is the comedy of this.
And a series of unfinished podcasts that never see the light of day. So anyway, we're determined to bring about episode 27.
Onwards and upwards.
Onwards and upwards. Okay, so quick announcements. What have you got going on?
I'm currently in the first week of my month of light, which we're meeting once a day at 8 p.m. UK time for a transmission of meditation. And on Sundays, there's satsang beforehand at 7 p.m. UK time. And that's running until the 11th of March. And all the details can be found on my website, beyondimogen.com.
Great. I've got in March, starting on March the 2nd, Saturday, March 2nd, I've got a month of satsangs, which I'm calling the Spiritual Foundation series, because each week the satsang will be touching on or looking through the lens of what I consider to be a spiritual foundation, things like meditation, self-inquiry, prayer, transmission. So each week we'll be looking at a different one. It's satsang. It is exploring our reality in real time. But yeah, join me in March. If you want to find out about that, go to martinweber.com/events. I'll spell that out because I've got the Welsh variant of Martin. MartinWeber. .com/events.
And that's at 5 p.m. on 5 p.m. UK on Saturdays.
Time. Yeah. Okay, so this week we're going to jump off on faith, which is a different angle.
Yeah.
When we talk about practice and paths and
inquiry,
but also recognition, you know, the difference between provisional and definitive, relative and absolute ways of understanding and recognizing. And so I've been going down a little rabbit hole of Pure Land Buddhism, just purely out of interest, really. And, you know, it's a faith-based thing. It's based on not on practice, but on a deep recognition. I mean, I'm parsing this through my own lens here, but this understanding that life itself is already calling us back home to our true nature all the time. It's not like we have to fight for it. It's not like the ego can do anything to get liberated, actually.
Not ultimately. I mean, that's such a provisional viewpoint. Yes. The ego feeling that it's making self-effort to bring about liberation. And actually, in the sort of the final shift of that perspective is the recognition of, oh, I was never doing any of this.
No. There's nothing I can do. Yeah. I mean, that's a refrain you hear fairly often in non-dual teachings. There's nothing you can do. There's no one here to do it, and they're all true. So there's this provisional the notion in say Pure Land is to just abandon all effort then in that sense. Not strictly. There are different variations on it, but in the one that I was looking at, the viewpoint is that in order to attain one's liberation, you put your faith in Amida Buddha to do it, and he'll, you know, transfer his merit to you and do the work. I mean, whether you ideate that as a living Buddha in a personification, a true person, or the, you know, anthropomorphic, you know, view of a law of nature, let's say, of being. The idea is there's nothing you can do, But there's nothing beyond that. That's a very disempowering thing, and you hear that a lot in non-dual. There's nothing you can do.
Yeah, it's quite nihilistic in its
view. But here's the other. Here's a sort of slight variant on that. There's nothing you need to do.
Yeah, that's where the heart takes it on board.
Yeah,
because and it's a very Christian message in some ways.
It has its correlates. Yeah.
Yeah. And but yeah, the mind takes that on in a sort of a quite a negative sense of it.
Well, there's nothing you can do. Yeah,
and it's very disempowering. But when the heart hears, there's nothing you need to do.
Yeah,
there's where then you really trust. Start to rest into that space of home, that faith of the heart, that grace that carries you.
Yeah, I think there's a pre-trans fallacy in here as well that can just to. Point out this idea. I think it's something that Ken Wilber talked about, pre-trans being a fallacy. And I've, in my experience, our experience actually, you might notice it. You might be, say, I'll use a practical example of it. Like I remember being involved, say, in the TM movement. Okay, so there's a certain spiritual center of gravity and teaching that was around that. And I found myself going beyond that, actually, beyond that kind of what appeared to be the teaching. And so instead of being just about my, you know, meditation twice a day, I was getting involved with, you know, direct inquiry and presence-based, let's say, practices. So it wasn't just meditation in the meditation hall. It was every moment being present, being aware, returning to presence, taking short moments.
Yeah, you could broadly speak of TM as a progressive path, and what you're there talking about is more of a direct path.
Exactly. But to the people who were still practicing that progressive path, it looked like I'd fallen off the path.
Yeah.
So this idea of the pre-trans fallacy is if someone goes further to people who are actually in a particular, say, developmental center of gravity, it might look to them like you've fallen off. Yeah. But in fact, you've taken a step beyond it.
Yeah.
So...
And then there are those that have actually fallen off. So, you know, it's very hard to judge that.
Exactly. So when we're talking about this idea that there's nothing you can do or there's nothing you need to do, you know, it depends on where you are, how you're going to hear that.
Yeah.
And what are you going to necessarily do about that? Because I do get exposed to, I meet with people who go, well, I'm told there's nothing I need to do, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, yes and no, right? Is that fair to say?
Yeah, if you haven't traversed and transcended the one who is doing, the one who is doing will hear that as great. I don't have to do anything, and just I'm going to sit back and enjoy.
Yeah,
and actually, suffering still is there because there's still the one who thinks. They do need to do
such
something.
A mind fuck.
And then there are those that have recognized their true nature.
Yes.
And that takes on a whole different meaning of there's nothing to do. And it takes on the meaning of there is nothing to do. And there is no one to do it.
I gotta laugh because, you know, as I'm saying, as we're exploring this, what dawns on me so strongly is that we have to speak to someone and speak to where someone is. It's very hard to have a universal
teaching. We were talking about this the other day, actually this is one of the podcasts that didn't make it out.
Oh yeah.
And we were talking about how you can't talk in the abstract.
No.
Satsang is always about the individual question. It's always about the individual suffering.
Yeah.
And the exploration comes from that. Now, invariably, it always gets to the universal principles, the abstract recognition of it. But it always starts very intimately in the individual experience.
There's a pain point somewhere in the individual experience that gets addressed, and that opens up then into a seeing, a recognition of of that in context, which can be, you can derive a universal from that then. But, you know, as I'm speaking here, and we're talking about things like pre-trans fallacies where it depends.
Yeah.
You know, well, you know, if an ego hears there's nothing to do, but actually stops all kind of, you know, inquiry efforting or whatever. But then in the other, then in a different understanding, and it's a fair understanding, that in some ways all the practices, and actually this was kind of my experience, it was both, and all my practicing over the years and all the inquiry and all the efforts that were being made, we've talked about this before, that those are in fact, you could view them as symptoms of consciousness, you know, rising or whatever, expanding. But at a certain point in my own path, and the point that preceded at my actual, you know, abiding recognition, was the fact that this isn't gonna do anything. Like, this is not, that these efforts, meditations and whatever devotions, practices, all of this stuff, isn't it actually it's grace in the end?
Yeah.
And so none of my personal efforts can lead me to my own liberation.
And so there's the faith. At that point, there's the faith. The faith is, if I let go, if I surrender, if I put my head on the floor of life and bow to that, that it will be taken care of.
It will be taken care of.
That I am taken care of. That liberation is not in my hands. And it's funny, this has come up so many times this week for me, this idea of not my will be done, but thy will be done.
Yeah.
And actually that sort of pivots to, I don't want to pivot, go down too much of a rabbit hole, but just for a moment, this recognition, I've been having this conversation a few times this week in private one-on-one sessions, where the loss of God.
Yeah.
And in what happens with the loss of God culturally is the burdens are laid on the personal self, on the small self, of I am succeeding, I am doing, I am failing, I am.
Me.
And this speaks to what we're talking about here. Yeah. It's like the recognition where we give it to God, so to speak, and whatever your conception is of that, but where you give it to the higher power, the divine nature of life that we are fundamentally. This is where the recognition comes in. There's nothing I can do about this. I am not the doer of this. I'm just the witness, the one that is experiencing this life in this manner.
And in that sense, there's nothing, as I said before, nothing I need to do.
No.
In a sense. So looking at this idea about the place of, it seems, in these traditions that we're talking about, you know, Buddhism, Advaita and whatnot, and this idea that it's all about direct experience and practice and, you know, insight and all that. And so where's the place for faith then? Because we've talked about trust a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And so surrender. I'm trying this on for size and going, well, what part? Okay, let's look through this realization through the lens of faith, and say, from the viewpoint of ignorance also, or the person going, I'm just going to have faith that all is well and all is going.
Yeah.
And what does that, you know, and that's maybe not just a one-shot deal. Maybe that the development of that trust is itself allowing the mind to quieten down to know it's all in hand. It's all, because it is. It is absolutely all in hand. But maybe for some people, that faith-based approach to recognition and realization, the faith allows the mind to quieten into trust. And in that trust, the reality is revealed, shown.
One of my favorite quotes, Julian of Norwich.
Oh, yeah.
All shall be well. All shall be well. All shall be well. All manner of things shall be well.
Yeah.
I think I added an extra all shall be well.
Well, why not? I say all shall be well. Yeah. So it,
and it grows. It does grow, though. I agree with that. It's like where you know, I think of surrender and faith that very much go hand in hand here in this conversation, I feel. Mm. It's like as you surrender your control, your feeling that I am in control and I need to get this right, I need to do right, I need to make effort here.
Yeah.
As that is surrendered and sacrificed.
Yeah.
I think this is where faith grows,
yeah.
And the recognition of as you surrender, there's something else that is coming to sort of hold you up in life.
Well, it relates as well to this idea of kenosis, where by emptying oneself of one's person, let's say continually emptying yourself of anything resembling me, what rises up in its place was always there, really, is the divine reality, which is the deeper self also, or God, however you want to. I think those are synonymous at a certain point.
Yeah.
So it's the idea of can the ego just get out of the way, please?
Yeah.
And what's the mechanism by which the ego can get out of the way? And, you know, this is the thing with spiritual seeking is, so much effort at a certain point, and that's not wrong, but it's at a certain point it becomes this recognition that what's the recognition that the ego can't go ego can't do anything in regard to its own liberation.
Yeah, so where I was going to go with that, which is in support of this, to me, you know, so I get plenty of people who come to me and are having issue with the seeking itself, and they've made that seeking wrong. And in the context of this, you could say, yeah, seeking actually is not helping, but I see seeking as serving a different purpose, actually. To me, seeking is, it's almost like, I need to go down all the tributaries of seeking to recognize where it is not.
Yeah.
And so to me, if there's still seeking playing out, it's serving the purpose of seeing which road doesn't work.
Right.
And therefore, it dissolves any doubt by which this is not it.
Right. Yeah, beautiful.
And so I had this beautiful conversation in a session a few weeks ago, and where someone came with this very point of struggling with seeking, and I was like, can you trust your seeking? Can you trust that seeking is actually the manner in which you are coming to learn and coming to dissolve the doubt that is still left in your system that says you are not that?
Right. So I just took note here that take meditation and seeking, okay, meditation as one form of that. That the mechanism perhaps isn't what we take it to be.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that the mechanism of meditation will lead you to self-realization in itself, but it'll just lead to a point where you go, oh, this can't work. But you have to kind of, the ego has to, I've wrote and written about this in the past, we both have, that in order for real awakening to come about, the ego has to run out of strategies.
Yep.
And so as you're just saying there, you know, it's just a case of, you know, you try everything and then in the end you go, oh, I've tried everything, I give up.
Yeah.
You know, so you've got to put all that fervent seeking energy into whatever it is that you're going for, only to get to a point where you can actually surrender. You have to be humbled, in a sense. The ego has to be humbled and its powerlessness revealed, that it's nothing I can do. But you can't just think that, you can't just go, there's nothing I can do, which is copping out. I see a lot of people come to non-duality and they hear that, there's nothing I can do. And you can't just take that and go, there's nothing I can do, so I'm not going to do anything. You have to find out for yourself by whatever means.
If you take that in the mind, what I see happens is the suffering is still there. So it's not embodied, that recognition of there's nothing I can do, which leads to the recognition of surrender and therefore faith. But if you just take that in the mind, you're not actually living and embodying the surrender of life. You're just telling yourself that it shouldn't, I have nothing to do, and therefore this is nonsense. This suffering is nonsense. Yeah. And yet there's still an embodied experience of suffering there.
So I wonder whether it's something like, if we look at it from a pre-trans, you know, lens, that if you're going to approach that notion of there's nothing you can do, mm-hmm. or there's no need to do it, if that leads you into deeper and deeper faith, mm-hmm. which leads you to deeper and deeper recognition, all well and good.
Yes.
But if it leads you to just remain in ignorance with no greater faith, or and therefore no dissolution of the mind, the diminishment of the mind, which gives rise to this this trust and faith. So that's where
beautiful. Yeah.
You know. Yeah. I'm a little bit short-worded on this, because I'm just exploring this lens more or less for the first time in this regard, to see where the, because we talked about trust before now, and the need for trust, but also trust as a symptom.
Yeah.
Some trust, and again, it's about, you have to in some ways drop the notion of causality in all of this. You know, what comes first sometimes is what trust is both a way in and a symptom or a description of a condition. You know, it these two things become very interchangeable, and it depends on who and on what level you're talking to, whether you're talking about as a prescription, and therefore part of the path, or whether it's a description. Ultimately, it does lead to that things like trust and faith are actually symptoms of reality.
You see, so I come at this maybe in a slightly different language. I'm not sure yet. Let's explore it, because I don't know if it is. But for me, I feel like trust and faith are our nature.
Yeah.
And it's not so much about gaining more trust or gaining more faith, but it's about finding where there is mistrust and lack of faith and attending to that. And what shall be revealed through the attending to that is the ground of trust and faith. That's broadly how I perceive it, is that it's not a lack of faith or a lack of trust that is the problem. It's that there's some mistrust and some
what stands in the way.
Yeah, exactly.
Of those things.
Exactly. That's how I think fundamentally consciousness is trustful and faithful. I don't know, those aren't the right words maybe, but it's our nature is of that.
Yes, our nature is, it was that I Ching thing one day came up. I can't remember which hexagram it was, but it said something like, you know, follow the sage, meaning follow the sage mind or whatever, but it's not enough to, it's not required that one trust, but just that one abandons mistrust.
Exactly.
And because when you abandon mistrust, you find that the condition is of trust, is of faith, is because it's like, yes, it's all going exactly, that's the recognition. This is exactly as it should be.
Yeah, and so this is where I've seen in myself and also the people I work with is and broadly the distinction I make between faith and trust, whether they're correct or not, but this is my personal distinction, is faith is trust has sort of an aim to it, has a sense of what you're trusting. Faith is much less defined, as in there's an unseen faith of what you have faith in. Mm. It's just a faith. That's how I broadly would distinguish the two. I forgot what I was about to say then. Do you have any idea? No.
No. What were we talking about? This. I don't know. I see them, they're more or less synonymous in some sense, I would probably say, unless there's a...
Like, I feel like you have trust in certain things and you have faith has a...
Is that different from having faith in...
Yeah, I don't know.
Just another word from...
Yeah. I don't know. I lost my train of thought there.
Fine. Faith and trust. But there's a description rather than... But then we talk about this a lot. Where, you know, prescriptions turn into descriptions. And so, you know, it's what Maharshi used to say, you know, the knowledge is different in different states of consciousness. So that's a great, you know, you can be exposed to some idea, like have faith. And, you know, a person will take that as an instruction, whereas an enlightened being will take that as a description.
Not only will a person take that as an instruction, they'll look for someone to have faith in.
Right.
So that, because the person can only conceive of another person, even if it's a God-shaped person, the person only lives from the view of objects. And so... when you say have faith, there's an automatic assumption of in what, yeah.
Mm. Yeah. So the thought that comes in a kind of a nutshell is something like having true faith is... a way or a description of the ego sort of stepping aside. Because if you really have faith that all is as it should be, all is going as it must, though that kind of, not faith that I'm going to get what I want, but just faith that, trust that everything is as it must be, as it should be.
Yeah.
Then the mind really shuts down to a very quiet place of observation, which is in a sense, which is another way of saying drops into its own silent nature. Doesn't second guess. You know, to have faith is not to second guess anything. You know, and so much of our thinking process and therefore our suffering based around ideas about how things should, could, would go. A lot of second guessing, that kind of doubting.
Questioning life. It reminds me of this thing of like the hubris of who are we to question God?
Yeah. There was a great, Terence McKenna quote. He said, worry? Worry? You don't know enough to worry, you know. It's like we have no idea of. I mean, actually, if you look back at the book of Job back in the Old Testament, and I think God's retort to Job about all Job's suffering was like, "You know nothing, you know. What do you know about the foundations of the world and the depths and all these things that I'm taking care of? Don't even, you know." Don't doubt me. Yes. You can't comprehend what I do. Job's like, all right, fair enough.
A good friend of mine always jokes that we should get a t-shirt printed for me that says we shall see.
We shall see.
It's like one of my favorite phrases. We shall see.
So there's this faith in this our deep intelligence, the self that's beyond our simple minds, beyond the conceptions of our simple minds. It's just life is just too infinite, infinitely orchestrated for us to actually make sense of where it's going and what's going to happen. But dropping into that reality, we can witness the great Tao, the flow of that mm-hmm. intelligence, that reality that we are, and that deep sense of the knowingness that it's all going as it should.
Yeah, and actually that sparks and brings me back to round to the very beginning of this podcast. Where you spoke about the sort of exploration you're doing right now into a particular school of Buddhism. Mm. And please pick up where you can on this, because I think it was yesterday you commented on the chanting that they were doing in this Buddhism was not about the school of Buddhism, rather, mm-hmm. was not about a practice to achieve something, but was actually almost a way of saying thank you, or a reminder.
Beautiful.
Of that. And that really struck a chord with me, actually.
That's really good. That's a really good point, because so in the Pure Land school, particularly in the part of it that's I think is Shin Buddhism, that's the interpretation by a monk called Shinran, he was like, yes, the vow of this Buddha is to, you know, take you to the pure land. All you have to do is just call his name out. Mm-hmm. So you call out Namu Amida Butsu, which is, you know, I bow or I hail to Buddha, Amida. But that, be clear about what that's doing. It's not that the more you chant that, the more likely you're going to get your mm-hmm. result, or there's no mechanistic relationship. Exactly. There's no transaction here. It's not like call out the name, and the more you do it, the more effectively. It's not that
your,
at
your
all.
How many points for how many chants.
Exactly. It's just in a sense, it's just you're saying it to say thank you for the reality that his vow will take you to the pure land and you know, facilitate your full enlightenment.
Yeah. And it's thank you to grace.
Or in some ways, yes, thank you to grace. But also, in a sense, it's a comfort and a personal reminder that's the mechanism that's going on. You know, and it reminds me a little bit of centering prayer, actually, because in centering prayer, you use a word, usually a single syllable word, might be a bit more, but usually things like God or love or whatever, you choose the word. And it's not like a mantra. You don't use it like a mantra. You just use it as a signifier that, so you in centering prayer, you're sort of, you know, rest in non-grasping, open awareness. And you use the word, say it's love or God, to indicate that your own receptivity to the workings of the divine in that space. So using it like that. So it's not like a mantra you keep repeating. And it's just a return, and it's your intention somehow. So it's something like, it's more like that, but it's actually maybe even less like that, according to Shinran's viewpoint. There's no mechanism here. It's like look, we're being the Buddha. Our Buddha nature in the form of Amida is working towards our liberation, always in every move. And don't get in the way of that. In fact, you know, they call it the Nembutsu, which is to this repeating of this this chant, let's say, or this, or just whether it's in your mind or whatever. But there's no mechanism there. It's just thank
getting
you
out of your
or
own
remind
way. Getting out of your own way.
Getting out your own way. And in fact, they recommend, you know, in these schools, some recommend just don't go there, don't meditate, don't chant, don't do anything, just this Nembutsu only. You know, just and even this isn't actually
I wonder whether it takes a certain temperament, not only a certain temperament but a certain place in one's path. So a certain depth of understanding, at least, of the nature of reality that allows you to have that faith, allows you to see that actually it's not about self-effort here. Because if there's too strong an ego there that feels that it is in control, the temperament wouldn't necessarily support that mode of being, I would say.
It's really interesting. So the question is, what part of this is this path working with the ego to get out of the way, and what part of it is actually the reality? Is both.
And I could argue that it depends on the evolution or the stage of the evolution of the individual. And that is a description, not as a prescription. Like, so it just depends on where a being finds itself in terms of its temperament.
I find this a particularly fascinating path because it, and it's a bit like it does have echoes, and it has been compared to sort of the Christian doctrine, which is to say something like, however bad a sinner you are, let's say, or however unevolved you are from another perspective, just do this one thing and you'll bypass the whole lot.
Yeah. Right? But how could you hear that and trust that and live that if you're not open to that?
Well, exactly. And actually, one of the understandings is, I'm only just going down this rabbit hole, but it's fascinating. One of the understandings is that to even hear, you know, about Amida, to hear the chant, to hear in itself is the action of Buddha nature.
Absolutely. I mean, this is why we talk about it all being a symptom, because even if you are fervently, you know, efforting with your practice, even that is a symptom. And even if you get to the point where you recognize there's nothing to do, there's no one to do it, even that is
it's
a symptom.
It's all part of it, exactly.
Yeah, and this is what's so fascinating is, at a certain point, I feel like that is grokked. Like that's that aha, that that recognition, that realization, that revelation of, oh, I am not a person who has been in charge of all of this. I am consciousness playing out in this manner, playing this game, this character, this one that feels it's efforting.
I love this. So a side note on the character of this guy called Shinran, who was from that school of Pure Land Buddhism, but he went further. So, you know, this idea that chanting the name of Amida Buddha would itself call on Amida Buddha to fulfill his vow, which says, look, if you call on me, don't worry about your practice. When you die, you'll come to the Pure Land, and then it'll be real easy for you. We'll get there. And, you know, so, and it does. And part of that was because we're so in this age, so hard to do the way of the sage, as he called it. That this is the way to reach, you know, the lowest of the low, the people who wouldn't have access to spiritual practice and teaching. It's just like anyone can do this. Just give them the nembutsu, the chant. But Shinran went further, and he was a monk, but then he became so completely I can't think of the right word.
Disillusioned?
He became so completely absorbed in this way of seeing.
I see.
Convinced of this way of being and liberated through it, that he became quite an interesting character. He stopped being a celibate monk and got married and had like 7 kids. And he renamed himself like the bald-headed fool or something, Japanese for the bald-headed fool. And he says, I'm neither a householder nor a monk. And this was quite controversial to, you know, the monks of that time, even in the school that he got married and that he had to. And he said, well, if you've got no faith then in this, if you think that this is going to stand in the way of your liberation.
This is it. When people, so I see this all the time, when people have all these expectations and all these rules as to if you don't do it this way, you don't have, and there's this inbuilt belief system of awakening only happens under XYZ circumstance.
And yeah.
So whether it be the clothes you wear, the foods you eat, the practices you do, the people you spend time around, the places you live. I mean, there's so many.
And we do teach that way as well, but I think it's worth knowing, and we talk about this a lot, and it's become really a theme. There's a difference between the provisional, definitive, or relative and absolute teachings, because, you know, the provisional teachings or the relative teachings pertain to an individual on a path, and they're all valid as far as it goes. Okay, yeah. It's fine. I wouldn't not do it for someone who is there. But ultimately, there is no path, there is no teaching.
All of
there
that's
is
transcended,
no practice.
Yeah.
It's all transcended. And in so many ways, grace can bypass all that in a heartbeat, and it does.
Yes,
and
exactly.
That's why sudden awakening, and it's not even just sudden awakening, it's sort of out of expected context awakening happens a lot. And even while I argue or rather make the case for... when you look at most people who awaken, it's often, we talked about this, often the precursor for that might be years of practice or at least deep inquiry. But sometimes it isn't. It's true. Sometimes the whole thing can be bypassed, and then you catch up with it later.
Yeah, you said it happens a lot. I would actually completely disagree with that view. I would say it's rare that awakening is completely out of context and sudden. My viewpoint of that is, for the majority of people, it's progressive. I think that's the thing. People like the unicorn, the idea that that's what everyone wants and thinks is going to happen to them, and
they use that as then as a way to actually not
engage earnestly.
Even though there's no it's very hard to,
I know what you're getting at though.
It's very
yeah.
tricky to talk both absolute and relative at the same time.
It is. But we have to, and I feel like we're constantly called to switch in between the two.
I think we are, and I think we're always, you know, as teachers you're called to employ expedient means.
Yeah.
Which is to say, you know, you meet someone where they are and you know, I was met where I was. And
so I think, to me, to talk about sudden awakening is to talk about ripeness, and that ripeness we're not in control of. Yet sometimes there are certain conditions that give rise to ripeness. You're looking for your pen, is at the front.
Yeah, sorry, for ripeness you were talking about.
Yeah, so to speak about sudden awakening, to me, is to also speak about ripeness. And you know, we don't know what's going to bring about that ripeness, whether it's going to be a long-winded ripening.
Yeah.
Or a sudden...
Like an avocado.
Yeah, 1 minute is completely unusable and the next is completely over the top, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So it could be
a spiritual avocado or something that takes a long time to arrive, or a spiritual coconut or something.
Yeah, that's tickled me. I think that sort of ripeness, that suddenness of awakening can come about. Absolutely. But it's not necessarily the way for everyone.
No, I'm not. I wasn't even suggesting it was, really. But just this idea that ultimately, I think life and awakening in particular is always saying, hold my beer. Because as you were touched on earlier, this idea that we have an idea of what's necessary or required for it, and what stands in your way. Oh, I won't be enlightened until, you know, this thing is removed, or I'm living this kind of lifestyle, or whatever. And
or this trauma's gone, or this, I mean, any number of my body isn't in pain, my this, that, you know, there's
the big one, for me, the big one was being in a relationship, being in a marriage. I was very much under the impression, the firm belief that it wouldn't happen within that context, and I would therefore have to not be in that in order for it to come about. But actually it turned out to be quite different, that we both experienced. It's like life went, okay, hold my beer.
I think that's what's kind of amusing. I mean, it's also what's heartbreaking, but it's quite amusing that whatever we tend to put an expectation and a limited belief on, it's like life plays out through that very thing.
Yeah, it does.
So whenever you say, oh, if this, then not that, it's like life goes, okay, well, this is where you're gonna learn your lesson, through the
through your own self-imposed sense of limitation or idea of limitation.
Exactly.
Maybe red flag. Go find out where you believe you're self-limited, and then just dive all into that and see whether that's true or not.
Because there's the word arrogance comes up, and not in the traditional way of using arrogance, but it's this sense of hubris is maybe a better word there than arrogance, but the hubris of the small self that thinks
dictating
it
terms,
knows what the terms are for awakening.
Yeah.
And
I guess that's where I was trying to point to, that you know, whenever we lay down some sort of, well, it's usually this, might well be true, but there are always...
It's a bell curve.
Yeah, right.
You can describe
the
majority.
There's a long tail, is the point. Yeah,
exactly.
Of very individual, unique, and unexpected.
Yeah, and so this is why I feel like I'm constantly banging on about this, of like, to trust your way. To trust your path, to trust how life is unfolding for you, and that every part of your life experience, not just the quote spiritual ones, but every part of your life experience is your way, is the way and the manner in which consciousness is waking up to its own nature. And this again speaks to, there's nothing you can do. It's just all that's happening. Everything that's happening is part of that undoing of the misunderstood view of reality.
Yeah, and did we touch on this at the beginning, that this, or maybe this was one of the, maybe it was when we had a failure to launch with our podcast, it's already here, it's already present, this is actually it. And the question therefore is, if you don't think it is, why?
Yes.
If you don't think it is, perhaps I would suggest that it's just that thought that's actually standing in the way of the recognition that it is already this.
Yeah, and so
that's where faith comes in. If you know, have even to have just pure faith that this is it, actually is the condition of this being it.
Well,
because the mind just disappears out of the...
Yeah. Well, that faith is interesting there, because it's like, do you have the faith to sacrifice that singular thought? And what happens when you
that this isn't it?
Yeah. And what happens when you do sacrifice that singular thought, that this isn't it? What's the relationship to life there then?
There's Nisargadatta Maharaj talked about it. And I mean, you know, I think... it's well understood that I think it was Nisargadatta, actually, might have been Ramana for that matter, maybe both. Nisargadatta's self, his path was his master told him to, you know, identify the sense I am and stay there.
Mm-hmm.
And so every waking moment he did that, and within a few years he was awake to his nature. But I think I can't remember, it was one of these who said, look, it's enough to actually just, it was Nisargadatta, because he also said, my master said to me that you are the unbounded self. You are the absolute.
Mm-hmm.
Just hold that in your heart.
Mm-hmm.
And that,
there's faith.
That will do it.
Yeah.
And he said, I took him at his word.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there's a couple of different reports there, but it's the same idea. It's like, if you take that, if you have that kind of faith, that it allows you to drop all the doubting thoughts, to trust entirely that this is it. You actually discover that this is it.
Yes, exactly. So
because that faith is in alignment with the truth. Yeah. There's no point having faith that isn't like, you know, I'm a crocodile. I am a crocodile. I have total faith. You know, that's not. It's about faith in what is actually real and true. So getting those two.
And that what is real and true will assert itself and be known to you, will be revealed to you.
And that faith was the symptom of that in itself. So, you know, as practices too. No, it's fascinating, really, that on this basis that we're already that, can't we just drop it? I mean, we talked about this last time when we talked about different, you know, teachers, and, you know, Gangaji in particular would say, just stop.
Mm.
You know, call off the search.
Yeah.
And for some, that's enough.
Well, so that's what I was about to say, is that we're going back to the pre-trans fallacy there, because for some, that will be taken in the heart. And they'll be ripe of what to hear what that is actually speaking about. And for others,
like give that, up and go back to drinking and,
exactly.
You know, parties and live that, you know, life of heedlessness. It's not
what's being spoken of.
No, it's not.
And it's very hard to explain what's being spoken of unless you're ready to hear that. You're ready to hear that, it's heard in the heart, and there's where the surrender happens.
Yeah.
And it's not a nihilistic negation. It's not a terror of surrender. It's a surrender into the heart. It's a surrender into love. It's surrender into life. It's a surrender into God.
Right. So it's a surrender to, but it's also a surrender of.
Yeah.
So you're not only surrendering to reality as it is, to as you say, you know, the depths, the ground of your being, surrender to that immanence, but it's also the surrendering in the sense of the giving up of all the efforts that want to take you out of that the mind's efforts to you know, think your way out of this issue, to seek your way out of the problem. And that's, you know, someone like Gangaji, give it up, give up your strategies.
I just got the phrase of to build your home in the heart.
Hmm.
I don't know where that came, but it came, to build your home in the heart.
Yeah. Yeah, live there.
Yeah.
So yeah, you know, would that it was so simple, and it isn't, because at the end of the day, there is no one doing it. And so if you find yourself surrendering into the heart of your own divine nature and resting there forevermore as that, then that was as it should be. And if one finds oneself spending 20 years meditating.
Mm-hmm.
Like I did. And
then, it was softening you up. It was softening you up to be open to the flow of grace in life.
Well, I think You know, it's funny. It was almost like an escalation. Like, you know, from the simple meditation, you know, 20 minutes twice a day to more like an hour, and then two, 3 hours more, and then to every moment, you know, returning to, you know, awareness
in every moment,
as I remember, and deep inquiry, and asking, and then living in ashrams, and then before you know it, like, my whole life is oriented around that, and then suddenly coming to the realization, oh, I none of this, I this isn't going to do it. No matter how much effort I put into this, that is not the action of, it is not the thing that's going to liberate me.
And paradoxically, that is the moment of liberation.
It literally was. It was like within.
So actually that is the culmination of all that quote's work.
Yes, but not mechanistically.
Exactly.
It's somehow it's like you have to come. Yeah. And it reminds me of, it makes me think about, you know, my path and various sort of landmarks in my own experience that sort of yielded to a new, let's say, level or depth of understanding and recognition in my life, you know, spiritual growth jumps of insight and, you know, experience. And when I think about it, when I look at it, I go, oh, it was because me, little me, was humbled by something.
Yeah.
And recognized my own sort of powerlessness in a situation, and in that action of, okay, I give up, what else can I do? Yeah. And like a new level of insight was handed to me.
Yeah, and it's funny how the ego reads that powerlessness as a terrifying prospect.
Well, it's uncomfortable.
Yeah, but actually when you traverse into and through that powerlessness, there's where you find freedom, where you find liberation, and where you find sort of that opening up into new and deeper insight.
Yeah. Well, a breakdown becomes breakthrough, doesn't it? You know, but if you don't break through, it's just that you're just left hanging in breakdown.
Yeah.
But it's a Dharma gate. It is
powerlessness is a really powerful one.
Yeah. And that humility, being humbled, being humiliated.
Yeah.
You know, oof.
Being cracked open by life.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's beautiful. And yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm reminded of a little clip of a Dzogchen teacher talking to a group in a retreat. Talking about, look, the true nature is already here, always.
Yeah.
It's right here. This is it. It's not a riddle. This is actually it.
Yep.
And if you can, right now, recognize that, just drop, as Gangaji would say, stop. Just drop all your strategies. Put it all down, and rest it as this, in this. It's done. If you can do that, you'll short circuit the whole thing.
Yeah.
The need to go off
and to not pick up again.
But it depends on you whether you can do that right now, or whether you have to keep seeking for a while to get to the end of your seeking. I mean, that's why we called it the end of seeking. Was that's why this is, and we haven't really touched on why that is, because it is such a pointed part of this thing that what happens when you come to the end of seeking.
Yeah.
It's at that point which
you're truly open to grace, truly open to faith.
Yeah. The living reality of your own divine nature just is there when you stop the seeking. But you can't, the ego can't stop itself seeking.
No, can't it manufacture
it. It has to come to the end of it. It has to, you know,
run out of runway.
And that's different for different people.
It is. And that's why, to go back to the point of why I don't think seeking in itself is a bad thing.
No.
It's just, it's not serving the purpose that we think it is.
Yeah. And it's interesting to see how people come to their path and this work in different ways, and that the shape of their seeking might be quite different with different people. I think in particular about people who are quite intellectual,
mm-hmm.
That the mind needs more satisfaction to be able to be put down.
Yes.
Ultimately, the mind needs to be put down.
So it at least seen its limits. It need so rather it can be one mechanism can to be put literally put down, yeah. Or another mechanism is to see the limits of here and no yeah. further, and then there's the leap of faith beyond that.
I guess yeah. I guess what I mean is that you have to, if someone is quite mindy and that and it can be quite sophisticated, intelligent, and you yeah. know, and all that. But it takes more for it to be satisfied, for to explore yep. it all, to go, oh, it's not in there. That's, yes. I guess that's what I mean, to go, to recognize finally that, yes. oh, the answers I'm seeking aren't going to be found in this domain. Yep. And in some ways, like a very kind of, you know, big mind or a lot of intelligence and whatnot, sophisticated intelligence and intellect, That can keep you busy for a long time. Where someone with a more simpler, intuitive way about them might not need so much, quotes, knowledge.
It's true, but and then I've also
seen... To
get
them to drop into the self.
It's true. And then I've also seen those that aren't necessarily orientated towards the intellect, mm. but they are orientated much more towards the feelings and the felt sense. You can also get lost in right, that stuff
like
as well.
Very indulgent, can't it? And, yeah. And like but on superficial feeling
well,
levels.
Same in the way you can get indulgent in the intelligence. Oh, exactly, it's yeah, exactly yeah. the same. So it's like there may be parts of your experience, like your temperament, what your life path is, might have you seeking into these certain domains
yeah.
to almost and all the techniques and all the tools that you might pick up along the way to go into these domains only to find the end of the runway seek is not in this
yeah and but you have to get there
you
don't
do
you,
you have to get
you
there.
As an individual yeah. have to find out what at what point you can go yeah. At what point can you call off the
exactly.
search
exactly and so to honor that like to me it's like it's to honor that is your path that is the way in which you are coming to discover what is true here and that's why I say seeking has its purpose it's a frustrating purpose sometimes because we're like can I just be done already do I have to go through all of this there's that meme of like do I have to keep yeah. going through things that
kill me but don't kill me but make me stronger yeah. yeah
it's that one it's this we can really find ourselves in that place sometimes but that to me is how this seeking mechanism plays out sometimes
yeah. Let's leave it there for today.
I finally got through episode 27. I didn't think that was going to happen at some point. We'd just skip over to 28.
We just for the record, we tried a few times. And
life had other plans.
Yeah. Anyway, thanks for listening, everyone. Hope you enjoy. Hope it leads to some sort of reflection, insight. And if you like, then please like. If you want to know when new episodes come out, click on subscribe. And if you feel like recommending it to someone else, just share. Feel free.
Bye for now.
Bye for now.